Thank you for listening to the sermon podcast from Grace Anglican Church of Grove City, Pennsylvania. Our goal in every sermon is to proclaim the bold truth of the Word of God, especially the undiluted grace of Jesus Christ. If you want to learn more about our church, check out our website at graceanglicanonline.com.
One man come in the name of love. One man come and go.
Doc, I'm from the future. Many of you here tonight recall these famous words from Marty McFly from the 1985 sci-fi classic Back to the Future, perhaps the most famous time travel movie ever made. Stories that deal with the concept of time have always fascinated me. I think it's because they speak to an experience that is completely different than our daily lives. They speculate about the possibility of changing the past and altering the whole course of history, or experiencing the future and returning with the key to prosperity in the present. It's especially a popular theme in Christmas time stories, such as George Bailey's Visit to the World in Which He Was Never Born and It's a Wonderful Life, or Ebenezer Scrooge's Journey to Christmas's Past, Present, and Future. Through the lens of another angle of time, characters in these stories gain a crucial perspective that alters their entire future. Who could forget George Bailey's desperate prayer from the bridge where just earlier he had tried to take his own life? I want to live again. I want to live again. Please, God, let me live again. Or the image of the seemingly resurrected and lighthearted Scrooge giving generously to the poor and making amends to those who he wronged. How many of us here this evening, in the midst of tragedy, or in great personal failure, or in the pain of regret, have wished that there was some way to go back in time, to change the course of events, to take back those awful things that we've said, to spend more time with the people that we have loved and lost, or to fix what we've broken? Well, in our gospel lesson this evening, we see the greatest story about time. Not Hollywood time travel stories or black hole adventures, but about the God who created time itself and humbly entered into it to redeem all of our past and all of our futures. Looking at the first few verses of John's gospel this evening, I want to speak about the eternal Word and the incarnate Word. Looking at the first few verses of our passage, we read these. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. We see here that John is starting off in a unique way. For in the Gospel of Matthew, he begins by tracing Jesus' lineage all the way back to Abraham, through whom God made his covenant promises. The Gospel of Luke, while also including a genealogy, focuses instead on the birth of Jesus and the beginning of his public ministry. The Gospel of Mark takes a look at John the Baptist and with Jesus' baptism. But here in John's Gospel prologue, he goes all the way back to the beginning of time. He's unmistakably echoing the opening lines of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. For in the beginning was the Word. This language of the Word, which John employs to describe the Son of God, is the Greek word logos. Logos was a common concept that held a range of meanings in Greek thought. It could mean such things as the rational principle by which everything existed, or the ordering and stabilizing principle of the entire universe. John's usage of the word logos here surely would have resonated with Gentiles and with Hebrew people living outside of Palestine. But John's use of logos here is deeply rooted more so in Hebrew thought and in the world of the Old Testament. The Word of God, which is active and living. The Word of God that creates out of nothing. We hear the words of Genesis 1:3, and God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. The word of God that spoke through the prophets, the word of God that delivered his people Israel time and again. This distinctively personal word in our passage this evening is distant from the abstract and impersonal logos of Greek thought. Rather, this word directs our attention to the personhood of God, the word who was in the beginning with God and was God. John is making a theological statement that would dramatically shape the early church witness to the nature of who God is in Jesus Christ, the union of his deity and his humanity. For Jesus was fully God and fully man. We see in our text that not only did the Word coexist eternally with the Father, but all things were made through him. The Word is not a created being as you and I are, but is rather the eternal ground of all creation, of every universe. All creatures, great and small, exist through this eternal Word of God. In verse 4, we hear, "And in him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." This creative word of God sustains and orders the entire created order. As the psalmist prays, "For with you is the fountain of life. In your light do we see light." The word brings life, and it's the life that is the light of all men. In Genesis, God separated the light from the darkness, and the living word continues to penetrate the darkness today. John, in verse 5, shifts his verb tense. He has been speaking about the past, historical facts and history, the word's role in creation. And now he shifts to the present active tense. The light shines. The light is always on, and it never ceases to shine. This light shines in opposition to the darkness. The darkness in this context is not simply the absence of light, but it speaks to the evil condition of our world, the fallen created order, and the sinful human heart. This conflict of light and darkness is a great theme in John's gospel, and it strikes a theme that is universal across time and cultures. This great battle of light versus darkness. For example, across the world, over 1 billion Hindus celebrate the festival of Diwali each year, the festival of lights. This festival looks at the victory of light over darkness. The ancient religion, Zoroastrianism, emphasizes this never-ending battle of light and darkness. We also see this theme everywhere in our own popular culture today, such as the universes of Harry Potter, Marvel, Middle Earth, or the Star Wars galaxy. This dichotomy is embedded in our public imagination. But it is important to note that in our universe, created and molded by God, light and darkness are not equal opposites reflecting some eternal duel, but rather darkness itself operates within God's sovereign rule and control. In Psalm 139, the psalmist describes God's mastery over darkness. "Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as day, for darkness is as light to you." For the eternal light of Christ that brought all things to be shines into the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. In this word, we see the light of creation. But the word also bears the light of redemption, the light that conquered sin and death once and for all. For as we read from Galatians, "For in the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son." So now a brief word about the incarnate word. In our passage from this evening, the climax of John's entire prologue is in verse 14. "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us." John picks up the language of the word logos again for the first time since verse 1, and he declares that this eternal word that was in the beginning with God has now become flesh. Become flesh in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. The eternal God became part of his creation. We know from the rest of the gospel narratives that he did not come in majesty and honor as the rightful king, but was born in a lowly cattle trough in an unimportant backwater town. This is the miracle that we celebrate at Christmas time, that the eternal Word, the creator of all things, God himself, became flesh in Jesus Christ, all while not ceasing to be fully God. He did not take on some heavenly version of our mortal bodies, but truly assumed our very bodies, our nature, with all of our propensity towards darkness and unrest, yet without sinning. As one early church theologian writes, "For that which he has not assumed, he has not healed. For that which he has not assumed, he has not healed." Jesus became flesh so that he may redeem all flesh. His entire life being an offering to the Father, living out in perfect obedience his infanthood, his teenage years, his adult years, in perfect obedience to what our bodies were created to do and for who we were supposed to be, living in peaceful harmony and communion with God the Father. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. This word that John uses, dwelt, literally means pitched his tent. John is again referring back to the biblical world of the Old Testament. He is alluding to God's dwelling with Israel in the tabernacle as the Israelites wandered in the wilderness. The tabernacle was where God was present with his people and where God's glory was made manifest. John is saying here that people now belong to God through the Word made flesh in this Jesus of Nazareth. It is through his life that we now see God in all of his glory, no longer through tents and sacrifices, but by the light of Jesus Christ. And nowhere did this glory shine brighter than on the cross, by which he defeated all the power of darkness that held his created order captive. For on that Roman cross, we read that at the hour of his death, darkness covered the whole land, for the sun's light failed. And 3 days later, when at dawn, as the sunlight broke through the clouds on the first day of the week, Jesus' followers found the stone rolled away from the tomb. This darkness and light, the light that shines through the darkness. The cross of Christ is the definitive word on all of our death and deterioration and disease that we face. It is where we must turn to when the darkness is all that we see. For the eternal Word became flesh, and on the cross, our Creator became our Redeemer. In closing, I want to take us back to what I think is one of the most beautiful scenes in all of movie history. After George Bailey from It's a Wonderful Life visits the world in which he was never born, and after we see him coming to an end of himself, he is gifted with a second chance, as if he was resurrected. And he is restored with gratitude and hope. Even towards a life of monotonous ordinariness, of serving his neighbors at the building alone, caring for his rambunctious young family, and living in his drafty old house. The final scene captures George being saved from this financial crisis that he was in and certain imprisonment. He's saved through the extravagant generosity of his family and friends. And it's in the middle of that scene where the resurrected George Bailey is rescued by his community that the crowded living room belts out that glorious hymn that we sang on Christmas Eve just a few days ago, and the hymn that we'll sing as we leave here this evening. Hark, the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King, peace on earth and mercy mild, God and sinners reconciled, light and life to all he brings, risen with healing in his wings. Mild he lays his glory by, born that we may know, that we no more may die, born to raise us from the earth, born to give us second birth. Like George Bailey, we all need to be rescued from outside of ourselves. But it's not a DeLorean time machine that we need to travel back in time to fix all of the mistakes that we've made, all the damage that we've done to our families and to our neighbors. We need the God who laid down his glory, came to us as a lowly child, and suffered and died the terror of utter darkness on the cross, so that he could redeem each one of our past, presents, and futures, and bring us into everlasting life with him. The eternal word has come to us. The light shines in the darkness, and our future is secure in him because he has redeemed all of history, including yours.
Free at last, they took your life, they could not take yours.